Welcome to your favorite time of the week, Sundays in church.
Amen.
And what I'd like to do is to recite Matthew chapter 1. So if you have a Bible or a phone and you want to open it up, Matthew chapter 1. And for every name I miss, Pastor said he was going to give each of you a $100 bill. Okay? So let's see. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begot Judah and his brethren. And Judah begot Phares and Zerah of Tamar. Phares begot Esron. Esron begot Aram. Aram begot Aminadab. Aminadab begot Nahshon. Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz of Rahab. Boaz begot Obed of Ruth. Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David the king. And David the king begot Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. Solomon begot Rehoboam. Rehoboam begot Abijah. Abijah begot Asa. Asa begot Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat begot Joram. Joram begot Uzziah. Uzziah begot Jotham. Jotham begot Ahaz. Ahaz begot Hezekiah. Hezekiah begot Manasseh. Manasseh begot Amon. Amon begot Josiah. And Josiah begot Jeconiah and his brethren about the time they were carried away into Babylon. How are we doing? And after they were carried away into Babylon, Jeconiah begot Salatiel. Salatiel begot Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel begot Abiud. Abiud begot Eliakim. Eliakim begot Azor. Azor begot Sadok. Sadok begot Akim. Akim begot Eliud. Eliud begot Eleazar. Eleazar begot Matan. Should we do it to him? Matan begot Jacob. And Jacob... of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations, and from the carrying away into Babylon to Christ are 14 generations. Now, the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise. When his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privately. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Ghost. For she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, the virgin shall bear a child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. Then Joseph, being raised from sleep, did as the angel of the Lord had bidden him, and took unto him his wife, and knew her not, until she had brought forth her firstborn son, and he called his name Jesus. Wow, that's like $7,000, Pastor. You would have been killed.
I'm glad you know your Bible.
Well, the New Testament opens up similarly to the way the Old Testament opens up, just as the Old Testament begins with a very kind of line-by-line genealogy, and then it culminates with the creation of Adam, and then in Genesis chapter 2, then you have a story or a narrative of the creation of the man. Matthew 1 kind of starts the same way. The New Testament starts the same way, but this kind of line-by-line, dry, quote-unquote, genealogy. And then there's a narrative, a story to explain to you the creation, in this case, of the second Adam. And in verse number 1, the book, or scroll, technically, most scrolls are on average about 27 foot long. For example, the great Isaiah scroll that was found in 1946 and 1947, by the shepherds in Bethlehem at Qumran, that one was about 27 foot long and had 17 different sheets of leather that were all sewn together. So think of something like this, okay? And the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, as most of you know, Christ is the Greek form of the Hebrew Messiah, or anointed. And you can see in verse number 1 there, he's called the son of David and the son of Abraham. And one of the reasons Matthew does this is because these are the two essential, the two primary ancestors that the Messiah needed to be related to. David, of course, emphasizes the kingly reign, and then Abraham, of course, the line of promise. When you think of the Abrahamic covenant, think of land and family. Land and family, those are kind of like the two staples of ancient Near Eastern society that kind of held everything together. So you got the land and you got the family, and then you got the line for the king to rule over the land and through that family. And in the first, what is it, verse 6 verses, 2 through 6, that time period is about, I think give or take, about 1,200 years in those short verses right there. Let's start in verse number 2. Abraham begot Isaac. So let's pause real quick because some of us know. This is the genealogy, just as you have heard, through the line of Joseph, which gives Jesus the legal rights to rule as the king. But, of course, in Luke, that's Mary's genealogy. And so Mary's genealogy, as you might remember in Luke 3, goes all the way back to Adam. And one of the reasons why is because Luke's audience, the people Luke's writing to, are primarily Greco-Roman kind of people. And but Matthew's audience, they're Jews. This is a book tailored toward Jewish people. So he starts, why not? Starts with Abraham, the father of the faith. So Abraham was born in 2165 B.C., if you do the math, which is kind of interesting if you flip it around. Instead of doing B.C., and if you do A.C. or after creation, Abraham was born in 1948. And the math does play that out. That's no joke. It really does. The math shows that. 1948, after creation, which, of course, shows, among other things, I think, that God's still at work, right? 1948 A.D., of course, and albeit in unbelief, they come back. So, you know, this isn't the way we would do it. You wouldn't choose someone who the Bible calls as good as dead, who was 100 and his wife was 90, right, to bring about Abraham begot Isaac. Now, speaking of Isaac, when you do the math on that one in Genesis chapter 22 and you link that to Sarah's death, which is right after that, Isaac was 37 years old when God told Abraham to take now thy son, thy only son, Isaac. I mean, how specific can you be? That shows you, you know, that God isn't working through Ishmael, at least through the line of promise in any way, shape, or form, but specifically through this particular line. The Messiah has to come through this line. So Isaac was 37, and he could have definitely, couldn't he have resisted? I mean, I am 44. Maybe I look 37. I don't know. No, but yeah, I mean, you could see how a 37-year-old could easily overpower a 100-year-old man, but he submitted himself, right, like a sheep led to the slaughter. He just put his neck out there, and whatever you're going to do, Dad, do. And then, of course, as you know, at the last second, literally the last second, after he stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son, the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And because he did that, as you know, the second blessing that that angel gives, because thou hast done this and hath not withheld thy son, thy only son from me, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed, which we're looking at here, as the stars of heaven, and as the sand that is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed, or now through Isaac, and then of course eventually through Jesus, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Interesting. And then Isaac, of course, you know, he gives birth, as we see here, to Jacob. And this is another way that way you wouldn't have done it. The way we would have done it is it something I said? No? Okay. Just get up and walk out. Like, what? you know, we wouldn't have done it this way. You would have chose the firstborn to receive the inheritance, right? But God didn't do that, did he? Right? God kind of seems to work counterculturally many times, right? Where he picks Abel instead of Cain, the firstborn. And he picks Isaac instead of Ishmael, the firstborn. He picks Jacob instead of Esau, the firstborn, and on and on and on. And that phrase, Jacob begot Judah and his brethren, that phrase, and his brethren, then that's the pool through which the Messiah is going to come from. So one of those 12 boys, you know, each one has approximately 8-point-something% chance, right, of them being the person, the progenitor of that line through whom the Messiah is going to come. And, you know, genealogies are really important to Jews, aren't they? I mean, you know, you couldn't, like when you first came into Canaan, you wouldn't be like, you know, I think I want to live by Haifa, by the beach, you know, where it's really nice, and we get that nice, I mean, you got to live where your tribal allotment is, right? And, oh, Daddy, I want to really marry that boy. Well, is he from the tribe of Reuben? No. sorry, kid. I mean, you know, you got to really, you just, they're really important. These for us, though, I mean, can anyone go back maybe like five people in your genealogy? Anyone? You can go back five? You can go back five? How about seven? Can anyone go back seven? Yeah, I can go back seven too. 10? Anyone go back 10? No? Oh, I beat you there. Yes. But you know, genealogies are kind of a little scary too, as we'll see in these upcoming verses of these kind of horse thieves and people that you find out who you're related to. But the point here is, though, is that especially on his deathbed in Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob blesses the 12 boys, in 49:10, you might know that famous verse where he gives the prediction that the scepter will not depart from Judah. So this is a line through which God is going to bring about not only his kings that rule from Jerusalem, but eventually his son. And then in verse number 3, you know, Judah, who was no quote-unquote saint, but he was the next in the line because Reuben forfeited the birthright. As the oldest, he forfeited the birthright because he slept with his father's concubine. Simeon and Levi forfeited the birthright because they slaughtered every man, woman, and child that had a heartbeat. And Shechem, after they made a deal with them for all the men to get circumcised to join our clan, and then when all the men were sore, they went in and slaughtered everyone. So they were. So Judah, I mean, he's the one actually in Genesis chapter 37 who was petitioning his brothers to save Joseph, or at least not kill him, sell him, to, you know. So that's the line it's coming through. But Judah, here's one example of people in our family tree who you might say, oh, okay. Judah begot Phetuz and Zeta of Tamar. So now we have a Canaanite cultic prostitute entering into the line of the Messiah in Genesis chapter 38. And once again, this isn't how, of course, God allowing free will and all those kind of things, I guess, right, to enter into the picture and to work through that. But like, for example, I'm related, I'm a direct descendant to, you ever heard of the Hatfields and McCoys up here in Minnesota? Yeah. I'm a direct descendant to the head of the Hatfields. And his name's Ants. He was so bad, they called him the Devils, like the Devil's Child, the Devil's Ants. So if I ever tell Revelation and my eyes light up all fiery, that's probably, I don't know, maybe where it comes from, but... But yeah, I mean, but this is, you know, and she bears twins, Phera and Zerah, and then the line goes to Phera's. And so right now in verse number 3, you're talking right around the time of the Jews going down into Egypt for 430 years in Exodus chapter 12, verse number 40. So the guys in verses 3 and 4, they would have lived and moved and had their being under Egyptian bondage. And then in verse 4, a bunch of people that most of us don't know anything about, but one of them, for example, is Nahshon. And so Nahshon, guys, he was the prince, the leader, the head of the tribe of Judah when they were marching through the wilderness on their way out of Egypt. So each of these 12 tribes would have had their own representative. We'll call him a prince, for example. It's kind of like the military, like a chain of command, and these guys would have had meetings with Moses or Aaron or something like that, and to be able to delegate, etc. But this guy, he was also married to Nahshon. He was married to the sister of, or his sister was married to Aaron, the high priest. Okay, so a very powerful, influential person. But the point here is, though, is that the line, the promise, the genealogy, it's staying within these boundaries of the line of Judah. And then we get down to, in verse number 5, we get down to the time of the period of Joshua and the judges, with Salmon and Boaz of Rahab. We always read about Boaz, don't we, in the book of Ruth, right? But we sometimes don't put two and two together that his mother was Rahab the harlot. So we can kind of pinpoint now the chronology conservatively to about 1400 BC, give or take, somewhere in that time period. And, you know, Rahab, she ends up, she comes out shining at the end because in the New Testament, she gives a double place of honor. James mentions her as a model of faith, and so does the author of Hebrews. And then in verse number 6, so this first section, guys, this first section has 14 names in it. Each of these three sections has 14 names, and that's deliberate. And this first section, it kind of comes across with the feeling that Israel was born for greatness, okay? You have the promise made to Abraham, you have God working through the impossible to bring about his people, and then bring them down into Egypt and bring them back out. And now they're inheriting the land. And now they have a monarchy in Jerusalem. And things are just looking really, really great. That's how the first section ends there. Now, the second section, though, in verses, we could say also 6 through down through verse number 11, Like I said, this one also has 14 names, and we'll explain why later. But this one comes across at the end that Israel's lost its greatness right off the bat. So David the king, by the way, all of these names, guys, in the second section right here, in verses 6 through 11, all these names are all descendants of Abraham, descendants of Isaac, descendants of David, who were the king in Jerusalem. And so this second block, guys, in verses 6 through 11, this one covers a period of about 400 years, give or take, from 1000 BC down to 586 BC. Well, what happens here? Well, things go south quick. Solomon is mentioned, and Solomon, of her that had been the wife of Uriah, so Matthew doesn't want to name Bathsheba. He kind of blushes at that fact. Because one of the purposes is, as David is all about, or Matthew's all about painting David in a picture that is upright and that is pristine, which David was for the most part. For example, the chronicler, who, as we'll touch on in a moment, Matthew is using the chronicler as his ancestry.com, as his primary source to write this genealogy. And the chronicler, when he writes about King David, he is shining. He is like that Michelangelo statue that is just flawless. I mean, the chronicler doesn't mention anything about Bathsheba, you know, no stinky sins, nothing like that. I mean, he's perfect. The only sin he commits is the census in the chronicler. That's it. Because it was the chronicler's prerogative to paint him that way. It was true, but he just decided to leave out some of the dirty laundry. And Matthew's doing the same kind of thing because Jesus in this book is all about being the son of David, and you can't have the patriarch of the faith, like a George Washington figure in this book, right, come across as being flawed in too many ways. But then we get down to verse number 7, and Solomon begot Rehoboam, and Rehoboam begot Abijah, and Abijah begot Asa, and then in verse number 8. So in those two verses, in verses 7 and 8, just for example, if you look back in the chronicler where Matthew is using as his primary source there, Matthew is deliberately leaving out names from this genealogy. Just for example, in verses 2 to 6 right there, that was a period of 1,200 years. 1,200 years. But in verses 6 to 11, it's only 400 years. Now, I know the ages of these guys didn't go up. They went down. But he's deliberately doing that because, I'll save that for the end. But some of the people that he leaves out are the illegitimate rulers of Jerusalem, daughters or children, I should say, of Ahab and Jezebel, like Athaliah and et cetera, and their three sons. What are their names there? Ahaziah, Joash, and Amaziah, if you care. Verses 9 and 10, we start to get down now to where the clock is about to hit midnight. God has really shown his grace and his favor on the nation. He's blessed them with wealth and with prosperity and with freedom and liberty and all these kind of great things. And this golden era, this golden age of Israel has really passed. And the leaders, the hierarchy, the politicians of the country now are corrupt and wicked and nasty. And like literally in verses 9 and 10, some of these people are sacrificing children to the god Moloch and Moab. I mean, just things are absolutely positively like the handwriting's on the wall. We're in big trouble in Little China. But still, God intervenes in verse 11 and in the midst of that darkness and chaos, gives them a light. Gives them someone like Josiah or something like that to bring about a very short-term revival. Kind of sound familiar, right? Just to bring about like a short-term revival in the country to bring light, right, for a little bit of time. And then what happens? Boom, the darkness comes back in, overwhelms the nation. And in verse number 11, God's had it with the people. And he sends the Babylonians in as his instrument to chastise them and destroy Jerusalem and the temple. And boom. Now, one name I just want to point out real quick. In verse number 11, one of those kings, Josiah, who is fantastic, as you know, begot Jeconiah. Now, the reason I bring him up is because in Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 30, Jeremiah entered into the throne room of the king, and I don't have the verse memorized. Is that okay? Yeah, okay. He comes into the king, and long story short, he curses the king, and he proclaims that none of the king's children or descendants will ever rule again from the throne in Jerusalem. There is an eternal curse put on the throne. Ooh. And so if you look at history, when they come back under Ezra and Nehemiah, 70 years later, 516 and following, they're a satrap under the Persians. And sure, Zerubbabel's there and Nehemiah's there, but they're like governors. They're not the king of Jerusalem. And then during the, because it's Hanukkah now. Did we know that? It is Hanukkah. And the Maccabeans, which is why they celebrate Hanukkah, there was no Jewish kings ruling there. And Herod the Great, he wasn't a Jew. Herod the Great's father was a Greco-Roman pagan priest in Ashkelon, according to Josephus, and his mother was, did you ever see Raiders of the Lost Ark? You know, at the end of the movie, when they're at Petra, right? That's where Herod the Great's mother was from. So he's, and the Herod the Great's descendants, about 150 years earlier, were forced converted to Judaism by the sword. So he doesn't have an ounce of Jewish blood in him. That's why maybe the wise men say, whereas he is born king of the Jews. You weren't born king of the Jews, you snake. You slithered your way in through the back door of the smoky back room of politicians in Rome. So there's a big problem. There's a curse on the throne. And that is one of the reasons why, as we'll see, that Jesus had to go around that and be adopted. And then we get to verses 12 through 16. And these short four or five verses here, this is a time period of 600 years. And we really don't know any of the names of these guys mentioned in this section. Of course, we know Zerubbabel. Everyone knows him. But even though we don't know their names, we do know this. We have people mentioned here, like, for example, where are we? Abiud, right there. Abiud, his name, Ab, is a clipped form of Abba, or father. And Iud is a clipped form of Yehuda, or Jew, Judah. So his name means Abiud. His name means I'm the father of Judah. So it shows that even in the midst of darkness, even in the midst of calamity, even though it looks, even though a curse has been put on the throne, right? And even though some of these guys are in exile and dispersed abroad, that the line of Judah is continuing in the midst of this darkness. You have another guy here named Elihud. Elihud. El is a clip form of Elohim, or God. And Ehud, same thing. My God, he's saying, is the God of Judah. So God is still at work, even though we're in this intertestamental period where we have no books, right, that are in our canon between Matthew and Malachi. It's this period of darkness and silence, but God's still at work. And then, interestingly, in verse number 16, you probably notice here that it says, so-and-so begat so-and-so and so-and-so. By the way, when I was a student in Jerusalem, that's where I met my wife, by the way. She's from St. Cloud, wherever that was. And I was from Illinois, and then we met there. She called her mom and dad. I met a guy in the Middle East, mom, dad, I'm so excited. And they're like, whoa, time out. No, it's okay, he's from Illinois. I'm like, okay, I guess. But anyways, when I was a student there, I would go into the old city, because the school I went to, it's located right on the tip of modern-day Mount Zion. Right, like down there is the Valley of Gehenna, you know. And I've seen hell freeze over. I was in there and it snowed before. And, well, not really, but I used to go into the old city all the time and get energy drinks. I don't do that anymore. Okay, but they're not good for you. And but anyways, I'm walking by, and on the western wall of Jerusalem, not the western wall, not the Kotel, but the western wall of Jerusalem built by Suleiman the Magnificent. So I'm walking by, and there's 100 Jewish yeshiva students, like seminary students, college guys, and just me. I'm like, oh, God, what are you doing to me? If they're there on the way back, I'll talk to them, okay? Right? You've done that before, right? If they're there on the way back, I'll talk to them. So I go into Jaffa Gate. By the way, all the gates of Jerusalem, they're named after their final destination, like Jaffa or Damascus or Zion or whatever. So I go in, and oh, there they are, you know? So I told them this from memory, because I thought they would like that. I didn't start with verse 1. Why would I do that? I don't want them to rip me to shreds right away. So I just started with verse 2. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac begot Jacob, and they're with me, and this is great, you know? Wow! And then you get to, oh, Jacob begot Joseph, because everyone here begot someone. And then you see right there in verse number 16, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Yeshua, who was called the Mashiach. And I booked it back to the school. No, I didn't book it. I kind of just walked fastly, you know. But as you can see there, he didn't begat Jesus in verse 16. And among other reasons, what that demonstrates is that Jesus, because he's adopted, he's the legal heir, right? He can avert, he can get around that curse that was put on the throne by God. In Jeremiah chapter 22, verse number 30. But then we have this third section here, like a 14 names, that kind of climaxes once again with Israel's born for greatness, because you have the proclamation, the announcement of the king. In verse 17, you got all the generations from Abraham to David, 14, David to Babylon. Am I off that much tonight, people? No? Okay. So you have these three blocks of 14 names. Why is it 14, Tom? Why is it 14? It's the same reason why when, Pastor, when you go to Bethlehem, remember when you go into Bethlehem at the Church of the Nativity, and you go down to the cave? See, if Pastor and I weren't married, we could probably be friends at a monastery in the desert somewhere.
Yes.
Yes, but we're happily married.
Yes,
I'll just stop there. Anyways, when you go into the place where, according to tradition, X marks the spot where Jesus was born, there's a star with 14 points on it. And it's because of this verse. Because in the world of the Bible, as some of you probably know, there weren't, like, numbers as we use numbers. So if you wanted to say, like, you know, you're number one, you'd say you're A, or Aleph, you know. Or I'll see you at 3 o'clock, I'll see you at Dalet, or D. That kind of stuff, you know? So since the letters have a numerical value, is everyone with me? Yeah? The letters have a numerical value to them. Everyone's name equals a number. And as you can guess, David equals 14. But so like in Revelation 13, you know, here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. And his number is 666. So in other words, John's telling those people, look, you know how to do gematria, you know how to do numerology. I don't even know how to do it yet. I will one day. What you need to do is you need to count the numerical value of all these world leaders, right? And if their name equals 666, keep your eyes on that person. Okay? Do you know what's kind of funny? You know how it's build back better, right? That's like the slogan. It's perfect in the B, sixes fit in each B. It's like build back better. Better is great. Not that that means anything. My wife is like, you're crazy. I just said, it's just interesting. That's all I'm saying. So, once again, when you add up the meaning of history, what it's all about is the bottom line is that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the son of David. And then you get to 18 through 25 as we finish up. Don't worry, I'll have you out on time. The roast will not burn, right? Verse 18. So 18 to 25, this chapter, or this portion of the chapter, it all takes place in one night. These seven verses, it all takes place in one night. One night in Bethlehem, or Nazareth. And in verse number 18. Now, the birth of Jesus Christ was on this way. In other words, these are the circumstances that are going to precede the nativity. Okay? The birth of Jesus Christ was on this way. So when his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, let's pause real quick. Now that phrase, before they came together, it not only rules out the fatherhood of Joseph, okay? But, and it's not just primarily of like a knowledge of a man and a woman. It's just not that. It's wider than that. It's bigger than that. It's just something like this. Even today, if you go to Israel and you rent the car and you go drive around the West Bank, you'll see a lot of houses with rebar sticking up out of the roof. Now, to you and I, you'd be like, oh my goodness, that is hideous. Why would you not finish the house, you know? But to the owner of the house, guys, that's a sign of promise, a sign of better things to come, a sign of hope, because there's a room additions. And so you want to marry the girls off as soon as possible. Can I get an amen? No. You just want to marry the girls off in their world as soon as possible. But the boys, you keep at home. Because the boys, especially in antiquity, they're your social security and your safety net and your line of defense. And, you know, they make everything run. The boys do. So when a boy would be espoused to a girl, and we'll talk about that more in the next verse, in the meantime, what he's doing is he's building room additions onto the father's house. And this is the same, that's the first stage of the Jewish wedding. That's exactly what's going on now with us, whether you realize it or not, is we're the bride of Christ, and Christ, the groom, is in heaven, and in my Father's house are many rooms, and the idea of the same idea, if it were not so, I wouldn't have told you. He's going to prepare it. He's a tecton. He's a carpenter, tecton. He's a master builder, and he's building this. And then when he's done, he'll come back, and he'll get the girl, And then he'll bring her back to the father's house. That's all. It's not like, see, the people back then, they got it because they lived in that world and those mannerisms and et cetera. But we don't. So sometimes it's a little harder for us. So that phrase, before they came together, that's the gist of what he's talking about. So, of course, the Bible records some miraculous births. Sarah, who was 90. I don't even think there's someone in here who's 90. You know? Ruth, right? What's going on over there? Yes. And Manoah's wife, Samson's mom, right? Those are pretty miraculous births. But this one, of course, is the best of the best. This passage, guys, tells us about the virgin birth. That's what it does. The cardinal doctrine, one of the cardinal doctrines of our faith. So what happens next? Before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Spirit. Uh-oh. You're living in a slow-paced, tight-knit, conservative community where everybody knows everybody. You think your neighbors know your business. At least you can get in your car and go drive somewhere. You're talking about a place where you would never leave unless you maybe went to Jerusalem once or twice a year at most. I mean, this is, you know, this is, Jesus never walked more than 200 miles from his house in his life, at least what we have recorded. That's it, 200 miles. That's nothing to us. And now I am engaged to this woman in the first stage of the Jewish wedding, and she's pregnant, and I'm not the father. Uh-oh. Verse 19. Then Joseph, her husband, now notice here, that phrase, she is called his wife and he's called her husband because they haven't, first of all, it's still in the first stage of the Jewish wedding, the betrothal period. The second stage of the Jewish wedding is the chuppah, or the put the ring on the finger and say, I do, and go on an airplane to Disney World or something like that, okay? So they're not there yet, but during that first stage, this is when they're testing each other's character, the father is negotiating the bride price and all these kind of things, testing their fidelity, etc., right? And this is when he finds out the news. Who knows? It doesn't say how he found it out, like through the grapevine. Like, how did word get to him that Mary was pregnant? You know, this would, oh my goodness, this is the scariest thing on earth. So it says right here in 19 that he's a just man. And John the Baptist, his parents are called just, Zacharias and Elizabeth. So basically what it means is Joseph is God-fearing. He keeps the Torah. He's observant. He keeps the letter in the spirit of the law. He's fantastic. He's just. And because he's just and he's kind and he's fair and all these kind of things, it says right there that he wasn't willing to make her a public example. In other words, when he found out, he decided on this night, I'm going to divorce her. It's over. It's right there in verse 19. He was minded to put her away privately. So when I wake up in the morning, first thing I'm going to do is get two or three witnesses, do it quietly, right? Because according to the letter of the law in Deuteronomy 22:21, yes, she was to be stoned to death. Now, newsflash, people always don't keep the letter of the law. And so maybe they were more liberal at this time, and there was, who knows how it worked, but I don't know. But maybe they kept the letter, who knows, who knows. But the point is that she's supposed to be executed according to the Torah. Whew. So he decides to divorce her in secret as soon as I wake up in the morning, and, you know, in the presence of some chosen witnesses. Let's try and keep this scandal to a minimum. And verse 20. While he thought on these things, that is to say, he's turned them over in his mind, and he's reached his decision. He's reached his decision. Then what happens? Just like with Abraham, because he is being, what's the word I'm looking for here? He's being obedient to his conscience. He's doing the right thing, just like Abraham is doing the right thing. Abraham stretched forth his hand, and he went all the way to take that knife to slay his son. And at the last minute, God supernaturally intervened with the angel and stopped him from harming the child through whom the whole world would be blessed. Basically, it's the same thing here in verse number 20. Once he's made up his mind, verse number 20, we have the ultimate testimony of the virgin birth. Maybe it's the same angel appeared unto him. And hindered him from harming the child. Now, What am I looking for here? Oh, here we go. Joseph, thou son of David. So what this does, among other things, is it shows us that Jesus came to have the legal status, the paperwork as the son of David, even though Joseph wasn't his father. Verse number 21. Four more verses, guys, and we'll be done. Verse number 21. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now, some of you know, names in the world of the Bible are pregnant with meaning. You know, Sarah means princess, which my wife reminds me of all the time. And, no, not all the time, just sometimes. And, you know, Isaac means to laugh, you know. But Jesus, the name which this church knows, is Yeshua. It means salvation. When I went to school in Israel for 4 or 5 years, I was a missionary there the whole time. Crazy, scary stuff, you know, like you're handing out tracts in Tel Aviv and someone comes behind your guy standing next to you and stabs him in the chest with a screwdriver. It's just, wow, just really intense there. Even though it's legal, according to the letter of the law, according to the spirit of the law, evangelism and proselytizing is frowned upon. But we do it anyways because it's what we're supposed to do. But one of the things, our main objective essentially was to clear up the name of Jesus. Because if you go to a library or you go to a museum or you ask any kid on the street, you know, who's Yeshua, they're going to tell you, they think it's Joshua because it's the same name. You know, Joshua, Moses' servant. They don't even know Jesus' real name because what happened is way back when the rabbis took the last letter off of his name, the Ein, and made it instead of Yeshua, Yeshu, which is, there's kids here, so I won't say it, but it's bad. Okay, it's a curse, basically. They're putting a curse right on his name. But his name means the opposite. His name right here means salvation. Verse 22. Now, why did all of this happen? Why did God have to do it this way? I mean, wasn't there an easy way to go about it? All this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet. So that phrase, that it might be fulfilled, that's used a lot in this book, 10, 12 times, whatever. And that's because, once again, Matthew is tailoring his book to a Jewish audience. And a Jewish audience would care that it was fulfilled. Luke, not so much. But Matthew's audience, for sure. So in other words, he's explaining that this birth was predicted in the Old Testament. Now, what's kind of interesting when he says, which was spoken of the Lord, and of the Lord, it replaces Isaiah's name in Isaiah 7:14. And that's because he wants the son to, that's in the quote here, the son to be brought in association with God to emphasize his divine sonship. And then verse 23, he quotes the verse then from Isaiah 7:14, that famous verse. And that it's kind of funny, though, that Hebrew name Emmanuel has to be translated for the Jewish audience. Why does a Hebrew name have to be translated for Jews? Because the Jews don't read Hebrew. They don't speak Hebrew. They're probably living in the diaspora or somewhere else like that, and they're just speaking Greek or Latin or something like that. So once again, meaning packed in a name, right? Because his name means God with us. Then he wakes up, finally. Verse number 24. After that terrible night, Joseph was raised from his sleep, and what's the first thing he does? The first thing he does is he keeps with his righteous character. He obeys the messenger that was sent. And can you imagine this guy? I'm not cut out for this. I didn't sign up for this. Okay? This is the last thing in the world. But if you think about it, God's pretty smart, and he probably was like the perfect person. Obviously, the perfect person for the job. He was cut out for it. He was a special man, obviously. Can you imagine living in some slow-paced, tight-knit, conservative community where even after Jesus is born, everyone thinks he's a you-know-what? Because that's what they did. Everyone would have thought that this child would have a scarlet thread or whatever hanging on him, right? And this tremendous stigma attached to him from in the beginning where he couldn't go anywhere, probably, without people, you know, mocking and railing and hissing and doing all these kind of things and gossiping and slandering this family. But this is the way. And God, you know, God, how does it go? The preaching of the cross is foolishness to them that are perish, right? But unto us who are saved, it's the power of God, right? This is the last way the world would do it, but it's the way. Because it takes something called faith, okay? It takes something called faith. So he keeps with his righteous character, stays with her the whole time, and then verse 25, of course, after the birth, he knew her not until she had brought forth her firstborn son. BTW. According to Matthew 13:55, after Jesus, they had four more boys, and they had, it says that they had, Jesus had sisters in Matthew 13:55. So there was at least seven kids in that house. That's kind of a, that's a big family there. But that's the way they did it back then, right? So forget this perpetual virgin Catholic nonsense, okay? He did know her as his wife after she brought. And one of the reasons I think, like even my grandma got pregnant. And then 2 months later, she got pregnant again. Which is very strange, but it happens. It's very rare, but it happens. So Joseph didn't, as a sinner, right, didn't want to come in onto Mary and to just do anything that would go against defiling and spoiling, right, that holy seed that was in her. So he totally abstained from her that whole period of time. And then, right, after the baby boy was born, the last line there, he called his name Jesus. So by Joseph naming the child, he acknowledges him his as his own. He therefore brings him in to this line. He's a lawful member of the family, and he clinches Jesus's place in the Davidic line, thanks to that hiccup to go around the curse put on the throne 600 years earlier. And like, because you know Jesus is the Greek form of Joshua, so like Joshua the priest, he'll be able to mediate and to intercede for his people like Joshua the warrior, right? It's a great name, right? He'll be able to lead his people into victory, into the promised land. And this the genealogy and the narrative that follow it are beautiful testimonies of God's grace. So God works through the messiness of life to bring people to faith through the ministry of his son, right? Jesus didn't come to call the righteous, but sinners, like the people in your family tree and the people in his family tree. And of course, I know it's kind of cliche, but it's true that this is the reason for the season. Sometimes we forget about it. And some of us, like, oh my goodness, it's Christmas. It doesn't even feel like Christmas, you know, and these kind of things. And I can understand that. But let's do our best to double down the next 12 days to remember it's Christmas. To have some fun, to have some joy, right? To celebrate, to bake cookies, to remember Jesus, to come out on Christmas Eve and do all those kind of things. It only comes once a year. Right, and this is a great time. A lot of people out there are hurting and seeking and don't have answers, and we have them through God's word. His name shall be called Emmanuel, which is God with us. Should we take questions or no?
Yes.
Questions? Comments? Concerns? Yes, ma'am. I don't know, because it doesn't say. But I'm sure it happened right shortly after the fact, you know, because she was, go ahead. I'm not sure. That's a good point. She did. That's a good point. Anybody else? Questions? Comments? Concerns? Anybody? I'm only here once a year. Yeah, maybe twice. Okay. That wouldn't surprise us, right? Because that was probably the thinking and the practice, especially when he came to fame and people started, you know, digging into his past to find out who is this person, you know. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah. Sure. It is amazing. God doesn't have grandchildren, right? Just children. You look at my family tree, it's just all of these horse thieves and hoodlums and drunkards and fornicators. Like I'm literally the only, not that I think I'm, you know, but I'm the only ordained minister in the whole family tree that we know of. Right. And exactly. But, you know, it's true. But you guys, you can do great things through God. Anybody else? Questions? Comments? Concerns? Yeah. Sure. Curse put on Jacob and Leah. Right. ask Pastor. And I'm not pushing that off. It's just off the top of my head, I've never thought about it. It's a good question. I don't know. But, yeah. What do you think? Right. Yeah.
We could look it up. I'm sure I've got some.
Yeah, I don't know.
But would you have had to, because considering the fact that he knew that God called him this, and there wasn't another man who could step forward?
Right. He was the one. Anybody else? Questions? Comments? Concerns? Don't you want to know what's going to happen next year? No, I'm just kidding. I think I know. I believe the gift of what, I don't know, revelation, I guess, ceased with the apostolic age. So whatever I say, take with a grain of salt. I don't think that God gives people oracles like this anymore. We can have opinions, but, you know, that's just my opinion. That. So if you see someone on TV or something say, God said that this is going to, as you know, be careful. Okay. Because it's, you know, pretty crazy out there, and it's going to get really crazy. Buckle up, people. I'm serious. Buckle up. Tomorrow's the big day. Case, yep, Electoral College votes tomorrow. Brought it to Texas and 16 other states, brought it to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, no. It's a state issue. Figure it out yourself. Done. Party's over. For some of us, and it's just beginning for some of us, right? I guess, depending on who you voted for. But yeah, it's pretty bad out there, guys. 1/3 of all small businesses, which is the engine of our economy, 1/3 of all small businesses, just for example, in New Jersey, already closed forever in the last 8 months. Over 20% of all small businesses in our nation are already closed forever. Gone. They're gone. Just in May and June, 35 million Americans were unemployed. 35 million. 10 years of jobs gains, gone. Gone. Now some of them came back. Like at the Holiday Inn I'm staying at right now, there's nobody there. It's dead. I mean, I was just in the Chicago area for a funeral in a very affluent community. Closed, 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 closed. Restaurants, everything done, shut. I mean, it's going to get really worse, guys, before it gets better. It's true. Be prepared. Get out of debt. Get your family safe and secure. Go ahead.
I was just going to say a lot of churches
are. We were talking about that earlier. Once all the dust settles, you're going to see, absolutely, you're going to see churches closing left and right like nobody's business. And that is going to accelerate a pre-existing condition. I'm in a different church every Sunday, like this size, give or take, you know, 100 plus or minus. And the vast majority of the people, your church is an anomaly, but the vast majority of the people in the pew are senior citizens. Now, don't think of like 100-year-old people, but they're just, they're 65 or, is it 55 or 65?
65.
Okay. Anyway. But it's true. I'm at these churches every Sunday, all over America, and 75% are senior citizens. What do you think is going to happen in 20 or 30 years unless Jesus comes back, when all these people go to be with the Lord in 20? These churches are going to be closing left and right, because there's no one there to pay the pastor and to keep the lights on. So this is just accelerating that. I know, like, just one summer off, there's a camp by our house in California, one summer off. The church, the camp, I don't know how, but they said they went 750 grand in the hole, and they're gone forever. Just once, I mean, oh, you wait and you see, right? And then when this really gets pedal to the metal kind of stuff come January 20th, it's going to be bad, people. It's going to be really, really bad. And you know what? My wife kind of makes fun of me. Not makes fun of me. She just... I told her, I think the Republic is dead. I really do think the Republic is dead. How can you change the laws in those four states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia and Wisconsin. How can you change the law halfway through the game? And then not only do that, but change the laws not through the state legislature, like you're supposed to, but by the wand of a pen of some kind of rogue secretary of state. That's what happened. That's exactly what happened. So if you can do that, number one, and number two, if you can take it up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court won't take it, you don't think they're going to do it again and again and again? And you wait and see what happens January 5th. January 5th is the Georgia state runoff. If they lose the Georgia state runoff, which they're projected to now, they're projected to lose that now. Even though it's close, they're projected to lose it. I'm not saying they will or they won't. They'll have the House, they'll have the Senate, and they'll have the presidency, and they'll pack. I'm not going to tell you if I'm going to pack the courts or not until I'm elected. That was the line. Pack the courts, 25 people. Now's the time to get right with God. Now's the time to get out of debt. Now's the time to buckle up, because I think it's going to be pretty scary. I'm a half-class fool. I'm an optimist. I am by nature, but I'm also a realist. We've got to figure out, right? Got to see what's going on in the news and live and move and have our being in the light of it. Maybe I just killed our offering. But I felt led to just share a little bit. That's all. Thanks so much for having us. And hopefully we'll see you next year.